Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome a second group of students from Hamilton High School, which is in Milwaukee. Would you all please stand from Hamilton High? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with a national award-winning program that is sponsored by ArrCourt and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students across the state are invited to come and hear an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they're sent materials about the case you are about to hear, and they may engage in some activities related to that case. The students come, listen to oral argument, and after the second oral argument, the students will meet with a justice assigned for that day, and the students and the justice will discuss the procedures of the court in accepting the case, hearing the case, and deciding cases. The students will not discuss, nor will the justice, the substantive issues of the case. Everyone is invited to that session, which will take place right here in the courtroom right after the completion of this oral argument. If anyone would like a copy of a summary of the case we are about to hear, please raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary of the case. Okay, we got one taker, and maybe more. While the marshal is handing out the summary, let me introduce the court to all of you. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice who will meet with the students after this case. To Justice Crooks' left is Justice Pat Robinsack. To her left is Justice Michael Gableman. Starting on my other side, to the right of me, is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'm going to call our second case today, 10 AP 878, Wisconsin Public Service Corporation versus RB Construction. According to my notes, Mr. Terwilliger will argue for 5 minutes, Ms. Westgate will argue for 20, Mr. Graupner 30, and then Mr. Terwilliger 5. Is that correct? Oh, the rebuttal will be by Ms. Westgate. Okay, thank you. All right, Mr. Terwilliger, you start, please.
Thank you. May it please the justice. The question in this case is whether the court is going to adopt, as part of Wisconsin's common law, the idea that a functionally equivalent analysis of an affirmative defense can establish a cross-claim in determining the issue of claim preclusion. Under the civil rules of civil procedure, which is the rules under which the Brooks case was brought, no cross-claim was made by Aegis. I say this because under Federal Rule 8, a cross-claim requires a demand for relief, and under Rule 12, an answer by the co-defendant. Aegis made no demand for relief against Arby, and while Arby answered every cross-claim asserted against it, it did not file an answer to Aegis's incorporated by reference affirmative defense. Federal rules do not recognize a functionally equivalent cross-claim. The respondent has cited to the court no case in which the court found an affirmative defense to be a cross-claim. The closest case cited is Montana versus Chautauqua. However, Judge Lynn Edelman in that case reconstituted the affirmative defense contained within the answers, which sought contribution and indemnification within the body of the answer, together with a prayer for relief for contribution and indemnity as a cross-claim without objection by any counsel. That is not the situation in this case. Thus, at the time Judge Griesbach entered the judgment of dismissal, there existed no cross-claim between Arby's and Aegis. This is important because the dismissal, with the exception of the contribution claims between Arby and Ferrellgas and the contractual indemnity claim of WPS, dismissed only those claims which were set forth in the pleadings. The order of dismissal provides in pertinent part, this lawsuit, together with any and all claims set forth in the pleadings, is dismissed on the merits, with prejudice, and without cost. Since no cross-claim was pled by Aegis against Arby, the order of dismissal does not result in a final judgment on the merits of Arby's rights of indemnity under the contract. This case was filed in federal court under the diversity rules and was pled and litigated according to the federal rules of civil procedure. The dismissal was in accordance with those federal rules. The Court of Appeals in its decision created a new functional equivalent doctrine to transform what was an incorporated defense pled against the allegations of the plaintiff Brooks into an offensive weapon against the co-defendant Arby.
Counselor, are you arguing to us that under the federal rules, in when the question arises of whether something is an affirmative defense or a claim of some type, that the label placed controls, or under the federal rules, do they still look at the allegations, the substance of the allegations?
No, they look at what the pleading is. There was no prayer for relief. There was no answer. So there was no claim asserted.
Okay, now I didn't say my question very well. My question to you is, under the federal rules, if there is a question about what the plea is, do they look at the label applied to it, or does the court look at the allegations made in whatever animal we're going to call this?
Well, in a situation such as that, there would be a motion to clarify, and the court may or may not reconstitute. That's what happened in the Mountain case. Because there was an affirmative defense, and the affirmative defense was indemnity and contribution, and the prayer for relief was indemnity and contribution. And the court said, taking a look at this, we're going to reconstitute that as a counterclaim. We're going to treat it as a counterclaim. Everyone agreed to that, and the court proceeded in that fashion. That, as I indicate, did not happen here.
But, okay, fine. Thank you.
If I can continue. As I indicated, there's no case law in Wisconsin or elsewhere that supports this functional equivalent analysis of an affirmative defense without some affirmative action on the part of the court. By creating the doctrine of functional equivalence, the court created an adverse relationship between the two parties when none existed before, and in effect essentially co-opted Aegis's right to determine when and if it were going to file a cross-claim. The record is clear that Aegis' attorney did not consider the affirmative defense as a cross-claim, as he did not prayer for relief, either in the body or in the prayer for relief. And Aegis likewise did not treat it as a cross-claim, as they did not file an answer. Further, which is, I think, significant in addition, is that WPS did plead a cross-claim for right to contribution under the contract. Arby's answered that, but subsequent to that, they pled the affirmative defense in answer to the amended complaint, which is the subject of this lawsuit, and no response was made by Arby's. They clearly treated that as essentially an affirmative defense and did not answer it.
Can I ask you a question about that? That's what bothered me. It comes in several forms, this question. One, is there still a lawsuit by WPS versus Arby?
Yes.
Okay, so that continues on.
That continues on.
And Aegis insured both WPS and Arby?
Aegis insured both WPS, Arby's, and Ferrellgas.
And Arby and WPS are not really on the same page. I mean, there may be co-defendants, but WPS wants to hold Arby liable for everything.
Absolutely.
Because that's the indemnification kind of.
Right.
Okay,
here's my
question, which is what you raised in this statement. WPS does a cross claim, right? WPS does a cross claim.
We do a cross claim, yes.
Aegis is insuring WPS. So if WPS wins, who keeps the money? Because, and I'll tell you, I'm careful in asking this question. My naive, simple-minded response to my own question would be, you would get the money because you insured them. So you would be either subrogated or you'd have an indemnification or a contribution claim, one or the other. And it's too complicated for me to figure out which one. So why are we here? If WPS still has a claim against Arby, still might collect, why doesn't that go to you? And another way of my asking that same question, different format, is you're insured as WPS. Ordinarily, the insurance company stands on the feet of the insured, WPS. So I would have said, simple-minded, hey, they made the cross-claim. They made it on behalf of us, too. I mean, if you're going to talk about form versus substance or functional versus label, hey, apply it to me, too, me being Aegis.
Right. Okay. Basically, what happens is WPS will get its deductible, which is, as I'm sure the court will be aware, is a very sizable number. But the balance of the money goes to Aegis. Aegis would get the money.
So what is this a fight about, the deductible?
Pardon?
What's the difference in the fight here? Is it about the deductible?
No, the fight is actually about the whole thing because it has to do with ratings and what WPS will have to pay back over the course of time in higher premiums. So it's real important that Aegis gets its money back, not only to Aegis, but also to WPS.
I'm not sure I understand your answer to the Chief Justice's question. In the lawsuit that's going to continue, WPS is suing, and they're going to get the money, if they win, they're going to get the money back Aegis paid in settlement.
No, they're only going to get back their deductible.
Why aren't they going to get back the money Aegis paid to?
Because that's by agreement, that's all that we get.
Ah, okay, there you go.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Basically, in its decision, the Court of Appeals...
Excuse me, it's your agreement with WPS that's all that you get, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you.
By finding and making this creation of this document of a doctrine of functional equivalence and changing the affirmative defense into a counterclaim, the Court of Appeals has abandoned the formal adversity requirement, and this enlarges significantly claim preclusion doctrine by applying it to parties who are not observably opposed to each other on the state of the pleadings. Anyone reading these pleadings would not conclude that there was a counterclaim against Arby by Aegis. In considering this case and the rules that would apply to the claim preclusion in this case, it is submitted that a better rule or the rule would be to apply to the federal court rules to determine what that court would have recognized as a claim. And at the time of the dismissal, there was nothing in the case or nothing in the law that would relate to the treating of a functional equivalent affirmative defense as a cross-claim. The treating affirmative defense as a functional equivalent of a cross-claim is not recognized by the federal rules of civil procedure, nor was it recognized by the Wisconsin court until we get the decision of the Court of Appeals. So that's basically, I'm sorry, Chief.
Your red light's on.
Pardon?
Your red light is on.
I have to ask one more questions.
You may do so, Justice Rosenstein.
I'm still having some problems, okay? Okay, you're suing Arby to collect the money that you paid in this settlement.
Right.
Okay. And you want us to conclude you never made this claim before, so you get to do it now. That part I get. But you're the insurer of WPS, is also suing Arby. I still don't understand why WPS can't sue Arby for the money you paid in settlement. I can maybe understand if you have an agreement between WPS and you that somehow they don't have to indemnify you for what you're paid. I don't understand it, but I don't understand why WPS can't sue the tortfeasor. It's kind of like the collateral source rule. I don't understand why they can't sue the tortfeasor for the full amount that was paid on WPS's behalf. Can you explain that?
The answer is that we're not able to because we, meaning WPS, doesn't own the claim. Only one they can bring it is Arby's, or I'm sorry, is Aegis. Aegis owns that claim. WPS doesn't own that claim.
Well, generally, there's one claim, okay? It's made on behalf of the insured. Whether the insurance company proceeds or the insured proceeds, it's the same claim, right?
Well, it is essentially the same claim. It is the same claim, except that claim is parceled out in parts. Part of it's owned by WPS, which will continue, which is the self-insured retention. The other part is the amount that Aegis, my client, paid out, and that's the money that we're seeking under the contract.
I still don't understand it, but okay, thanks.
Okay, I'll sit down.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chwilga. I'm sorry, was there anyone else? Cassandra B. Westgate. Ms. Westgate?
Yeah, please, the court. I think that the reason that we're here today is because it appears that the Court of Appeals has made a decision which really dramatically changes the law of claim preclusion, and it does so in a way that is very different than either of the two lines of claim preclusion that have been supporting claim preclusion common law, either issue preclusion or claim preclusion. And both of those lines of jurisprudence were very concerned with what we might call observable, formal, recognizable activity within the judicial structure. So if you look at the Roman law tradition, you go through res judicata and you get to claim preclusion. And the concern is with the judgment. The concern is that the judgment be enforced and the judgment be enforced based on known claims, recognized claims, claims that have come between adverse parties, formally adverse, in the judicial system. So that way the judgment has all the indices of judicial power. Then if you go through collateral estoppel, that's a German tradition, and it has to do with the proceedings between the actual proceeding of adversarial contest and the record of that proceeding. And if there are particular facts or matters of law that have been determined conclusively within that proceeding, and there's a record of that, then those are subject to preclusion. So it's really all about conclusive force and, you know, stopping things that have actually been decided, but based upon judicial power exercised in a formal and observable way to third parties and to all of the parties within the system.
Counselor, why didn't you just accept your claim along with WPS's claim? If there's two parts to this claim, why didn't you just accept it in the judgment that was entered in federal court?
Well, because in our case, Aegis, we represented, or we were in on a direct action statute for three of the co-defendants, and we were represented by one counsel. So the sort of oddity of that situation placed Aegis in a sort of, you know, kind of ivory tower position. It didn't engage in any kind of claims against any of its other insurers. So on behalf of
Arby, it didn't, you know, it didn't engage in any kind of claims against WPS. On behalf of WPS, it didn't engage in any kind of claims against Arby or Ferrellgas. It just stayed away from the whole thing. So it didn't, its position, Aegis's position is it made no cross claims. It made no cross claims in the Brooks matter.
That's fine, but why didn't you just put that in the judgment and say any claims they could have made are accepted, even if you think you didn't?
Well, I guess because it didn't occur to anybody that anything they did would be considered a claim. There wasn't, didn't seem to be any kind of requirement that you state affirmatively that you're not making a claim.
You're not required to make a cross claim, were you?
No.
So you didn't make a cross claim, so you didn't think it was
right,
out.
Right. It seemed like there was, you know, you wouldn't say I'm not making this claim and this claim and this claim because the claims themselves are supposed to be there and everybody knows them, everybody sees them, and the judgment is based upon that. That was the position of Aegis, is I didn't make the claim and I never thought I made the claim and oops, here I am.
May I?
Yes.
I sort of view this almost the opposite of what Justice Rodensack is saying. It is not clear to me why Aegis is not relying on the language of the judgment.
Right.
Indemnification claims which will be addressed outside the confines of this lawsuit. And then there's obviously the cross-claim referenced, and then it's reinforced in the third paragraph. Why isn't that the guts of this?
Yeah, why doesn't that take care of it right there? I guess the reason that is because it said WPS's cross-claim. And that particular cross-claim, the specific cross-claim that WPS filed, it filed it against Aegis as well. So in that cross-claim, sort of, you know, as a surprise, it was against Arby and all of the insurers, including Aegis. So in that case, we have Arby and Aegis aligned against WPS. So we can't really participate in WPS's cross-claim since we were, you know, the defendants.
You are on the one hand representing all these entities.
Right.
And at the same time, these entities were fighting against each other.
Right.
And so what I had that problem when I kept reading this and kept seeing you on all sides. The Aegis was everywhere. So what you would be caught in the situation of defending everybody, which you could do, and at the same time suing everybody.
Right.
It's a little awkward.
Impossible, basically, it seems. So,
did you provide defense to any people?
I'm sorry?
Did you provide defense counsel for any of them?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. I believe that he just simply was represented by one counsel, and that's how they proceeded in that lawsuit. Okay. So, with that kind of background, we come to the point where we try to enforce our contract, and we receive the motion to dismiss for claim preclusion. And the Court of Appeals made a decision which was not really argued, but it decided that the affirmative defense was the functional equivalent of the cross-claim, because it had the same effect and it had the same substance. And our position is that there is case law, of course, where you have an adverse party, you have plaintiffs and defendants, and you have counterclaims or you have affirmative defenses, you know, between these two already litigating parties that are mislabeled or, you know, and in the sturm and drang of the litigation, it turns out that it's actually a counterclaim. That's not what happened here, because a cross-claim is an entirely new claim that would require the institution of suit against a former co-party, not an adverse party. And the Court of Appeals looked, it said, the effect of this affirmative defense is, in fact, the same as a cross-claim. And we're saying, no, it's not. In fact, there was no effect with respect to this cross-claim, that would indicate that it was a claim in any way. So,
Counselor, when you file a cross-claim in a lawsuit, do you have to file a summons with it?
I'm sorry.
When you file a cross-claim in a lawsuit, do you have to file a summons with the cross-claim?
You have to file,
The question, when you file a cross-claim against a party defendant,
right.
Okay, so you're a defendant, you file a cross-claim against a party defendant.
The co-party, yeah.
Do you have to file a summons
yes.
with the cross-claim?
Yes, under federal law, Federal Rule of Procedure 5, yes, you have to institute process unless the court has engaged in a certain either exceptions, like if it's a very multi-party lawsuit, then they say, no, you just have to, you know, file it with the plaintiff, or you can do other things to sort of make it easier. But otherwise, yes, the institution of a cross-claim is a new claim, and it must be, you know, covered by summons.
So you're telling me under Federal Rule 5,
yes.
a summons would have to be filed to do a cross-claim?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
To institute the suit. And so our point is that the indices of the institution of a cross-claim certainly never occurred, regardless of what the, you know, affirmative defense statement was. Our view on the affirmative defense is that it's legal detritus that was, it isn't a correct affirmative defense. Certainly nobody could say that it is. But it's not a claim against RV.
From what you said before, the cross claim that was filed by WPS is preserved, could they still be suing Aegis?
They could, yes.
Okay. But would Aegis have no defense against that then?
I don't think it would.
Counterclaim?
A defense against the claim, because it also has, that would be some matter between WPS and Aegis, I would think, but the oddity of it is that this particular company could have basically two desks, and you know, one in which it was a defendant and one in which it was a plaintiff. But that could be going on. Strange as it may seem, but that's what we think. The problem again with the Court of Appeals calling this the same effect as a cross claim is, if you look at the affirmative defense, was there any response by Arby? If you look at the effect of a cross-claim in another lawsuit, the response is an answer or some kind of contested behavior on the part of the litigants, and it's also noticeable to other co-parties.
But, Counselor, an affirmative defense negates the claim of the plaintiff. What it says is, if everything you say here is true, I win anyway. And that's not what you filed. It didn't do anything to the plaintiff.
No, it was. It's not a good affirmative defense at all. It's not. But there are certainly circumstances where improper affirmative defenses get put into pleadings. They don't become cross claims because they're not good affirmative defenses. They become bad affirmative defenses that get either dismissed or stricken. They get just stricken, or they get modified by the court into something appropriate. They're just, you know, bad pleading. So if it was, in fact, a cross-claim, then Arby would have responded, and other parties would have responded, and the court would have been on notice that it was supposed to adjudicate this claim. I don't think that this...
Well, maybe they didn't respond because you didn't serve a summons.
Right. Because you didn't serve a summons because... What's to claim?
This is the summons that demands a response.
Yes. And so nobody's being notified that activity is required around this claim. And that's what's important for any kind of claim preclusion or issue preclusion, is that the activity of, you know, the adversarial process be noticeable, a record of it be kept, and a conclusion be reached, which is observable also. So if you look at, you know, there's nothing in the docket that says cross-claim filed, and you look at the judgment, then once you go to the judgment says WPS's cross-claim is the one that is preserved. That's the only cross-claim that appears to be preserved. It's not some affirmative defense cross-claim, if we would take RV's position, that would mean two cross-claims by WPS have been filed in this case, one as the actual specific cross-claim and the other as the affirmative defense cross-claim.
Did WPS file a summons with their cross-claim?
I don't know if they did, but or if the court had actually allowed or made a particular decision. I don't know that.
Okay.
There were a number of cross-claims filed in this case, 17, and there were almost 30 answers. There was a flurry of actual documents called cross-claims and actual answers.
Counsel,
we don't have
was there any difference in reasoning between the circuit court here and the Court of Appeals? Were they
yes.
both basically taking the same approach, or was there a difference?
No. Actually, the circuit court responded to RV's motion to dismiss, and it treated the pleadings as – it treated it simply as a claim, as actually it was a claim. The affirmative defense was a claim, and it was not preserved, and therefore claim preclusion applied. And the Court of Appeals seemed to agree with us that that was not a claim under federal rules or any other rules, and it fashioned a new form of claim for purposes of claim preclusion. And so we're here today to say that we think that new form, which is some kind of intermediary preclusive doctrine between claim preclusion and issue preclusion, which might be called the functionally equivalent effect doctrine, doesn't make sense.
Other than Judge Edelman's case that was referred to, the Mountain case,
yes.
Are there other examples where courts have used the functional equivalent approach?
I have not found one. The only case in which a word like functional claim was used was the Core States case, which is in our briefs that I have found. I mean, I did search extensively, but my Lexis skills are perhaps not perfect. But and in that case, that was a bankruptcy case, and they were comparing the creditor's objection to the reorganization hearing as a non-core proceeding to a later claim that was filed in the district court. And they said they thought that claim was functionally the equivalent of the claim that was filed in the creditor hearing. That was an actual claim. That claim that was filed was an actual claim in the bankruptcy setting. It met all the indices of, you know, it met the civil procedure rules, it met the bankruptcy courts, it put them on notice that they were objecting to the creditor reorganization. All of the co-creditors were on notice that there was this objection. So all of that kind of notice and calling down of the judicial process and the adjudicative process were happening. And in addition, that's a bankruptcy case, which is very, very different than, and even in that case, it said, of course, this would never do for a civil case. So, you know, we have not found any cases which either explain or use this functionally equivalent doctrine. And it makes sense that we wouldn't, because it seems to be adverse to the principles of claim preclusion and issue preclusion.
It seems to me that this case involves the construction of the judgment of the federal district court.
Yes.
And it seems to me your argument is that to interpret the federal district court judgment, you have to look at the rules of pleading and how you interpret pleading in federal rules and in the federal cases.
Yes.
And so that's your argument, is the feds don't have this functional equivalent, so you're imposing something on it that neither the parties in a federal case nor the judge in a federal case would consider.
That's correct.
Now, when we get, I mean, I think that's the first part of your argument.
Right.
The second part of the argument seems to me, now you're in state court, and you apply the federal doctrines to interpret the judgment. But the state rules as to collateral claim preclusion would apply. Do you agree with that?
I think that actually the federal rules apply.
That
Heinz case where the parties were allowed to counterclaim because they were not required to. It was a permissive counterclaim permissive cross-claim. I think that when the state enforces a foreign judgment, whether it be federal or state or other foreign, they generally will attempt to follow the intent of the rendering court.
So you're saying that it's whether you would do collateral estoppel or claim preclusion in the state court, once you deal with a federal out of this state's judgment, it would drag in everything from that other jurisdiction because that's what the parties were working on.
Right.
And when you add the foreign element of our rules, that isn't what the parties were working on.
And
now, what do you expect if you win? What would our court be saying?
I'm so sorry.
If you win, what would our court say? Okay, the court says you get another crack at this, right? The case continues on.
Right. The court would say. Well, also the court would say the court would probably also say, we don't do functional equivalent analysis. We stick with our previous analysis of claim preclusion, and under that analysis, neither this court, neither the federal court nor the Wisconsin court, would recognize a claim having been made.
But we wouldn't have to really say what Wisconsin would do.
No, we don't have to. No, that's
just your view would be that with the federals would not claim that. I looked at the appendix again and I hope I'm dealing with the right thing. It's Appendix 319, which is that's the general cross claim in this by WPS. And it's a separate document from their answer.
Yes.
And then Exhibit 4 is the defendant's answer to the cross-claim, and they're all separate from the original complaint and answer. Am I reading that right? I'm at pages 319, et cetera, to 324. That's WPS's cross claim. It's separate from its answer.
Yes. Yes.
Is Aegis mentioned in that cross claim?
Yeah, it is. Look at.
It's the general cross claim for contribution.
It's the general cross claim in the Brooks case. And Aegis is mentioned in sub 2. This I'm answering Justice Prosser's question. Aegis is mentioned in item 2 on page 320, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 line down, Associated Electric and Gas Insurance. They're making the cross claim against them. And it's mentioned again in the last line.
Okay.
Those are the documents I've been looking at. I just wanted to make sure I'm looking at the right documents. And I think I am.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Westgate, and you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Charles Graupner, representing RB Construction.
May it please the court. On June 5, 2008, after nearly 2 years of intensive litigation and difficult settlement negotiations, the Brooks case was settled and dismissed. Each of the parties, including RB and WPS and their insurers, paid their negotiated share of that settlement. WPS paid a portion of that settlement, and Aegis paid an excess portion of WPS's liability. So in answer to Justice Rogan-Sack's question, Aegis and WPS are each seeking independent bags of money, if you will, in this case. They have separate claims for what they actually paid out and are seeking indemnification for that.
My question really was focused just on old law, except that you've got an intersection of tort law and contract law. If you look at it here, the collateral source doctrine is generally applied in tort law. And here and there you can have one person proceed in a way that is compensation for more than that one person's claim. But apparently, according to opposing counsel, there's some kind of an agreement that they won't do that in this particular case. So that's why I was a little bit confused.
Yes, Aegis and WPS have acted independently in this case and not as privies. I don't think that's disputed. Now, Judge Griesbach entered an order indicating, quote, all issues are resolved and all claims settled, end quote, except for certain enumerated exceptions. WPS did negotiate an exception to that dismissal with prejudice. They negotiated a provision that says their claim for indemnification will be dismissed without prejudice. Aegis did not. And there is no claim that, in answer to Justice Prosser's question, there's no claim that that carve-out for WPS also includes Aegis. Aegis hasn't made that claim. And as the Court of Appeals said, it's clear from the language used, where appropriate, the term and insurers was added in that sentence. But if you look at the language, the only party that was granted the carve-out was WPS. That language was approved by all parties, and Judge Griesbach's order went on to say that the case was dismissed with prejudice, quote, the lawsuit together with any and all claims set forth in the pleadings.
But the argument is they never set forth a cross-claim. So it's not covered under number two. And your argument is it's not covered under number one because that only covers WPS and not its insured, and you're not willing to read that in. So if both of you can be right, why do you think that this is covered under number two? They never made a cross-claim. They never served a cross-claim. There was no answer to a cross-claim. I mean, I'm big on substance versus form, but they don't have to file a cross-claim, right?
They don't have to file a cross-claim.
So but they didn't. Now, why should the court impose a cross-claim on them?
Looking at the substance of what happens in the pleadings, and that substance governs over form both in the state court and in the federal courts, this claim was made not once but three times.
Which claim?
The claim by Aegis for indemnification against Arby. The very same claim that is in the lawsuit before you today.
Where was it made?
On August 10th, 2007, and I believe the reference in the appendix is page 127.
Okay, 127. This is a brief on 127. Is that the wrong one?
I'm sorry.
This is a brief.
I'm sorry, I'm looking at appellant 167.
Okay.
Now this is, and I'm looking at paragraph 172.
Still getting to it.
This is the answer.
What is part of it? What is this? An answer?
The answer and affirmative defenses filed by Aegis and by WPS through the Everson Law Firm on August 10th, 2007.
And which what are you specifically looking at?
Specifically looking at paragraph 172, Your Honor.
Okay.
And you will see there that Aegis and WPS are asserting the right to contractual indemnification. This is precisely the claim that is brought in this action, the second action. And while it is labeled as an affirmative defense, it is clear that Aegis and WPS are each seeking to be indemnified based on the same contract, the contract between WPS and Arby. There is no argument, I think it's conceded, that if this precise language had been labeled as a cross-claim instead of being labeled as an affirmative defense, we wouldn't be here. This case would be gone because this claim was clearly dismissed with prejudice.
Counselor, to stop you right there just a minute, just say that it had been labeled a cross-claim. I asked whether a summons had to be served with it to make it a cross-claim to which responsive pleading would be required, and I was told under Federal Rule 5 that's true. What is your position on that?
A cross-claim is not necessary. Excuse me, a summons is not necessary. A cross-claim, by its nature, is a claim between defendants. So they are already parties to the action, and there need be no summons.
What do you rely on for that?
I rely on, I believe it's Rule 8 of the Federal Rules of Procedure.
Rule 8? Okay, thank you.
And you can see from the docket that there were multiple cross-claims filed in this case. Not one of them had a summons attached to it.
Counsel, Rule 5 indicates, 5B, a pleading filed after the original complaint, unless the court orders otherwise under 5C, that there must be served on every party.
Yes.
And you're saying that doesn't apply here?
No, the cross-claim, the answer, and affirmative defenses were served on all parties. So.
Well, if we just look at 172, then I would say that under 172, Aegis and WPS are tied at the hip, and that therefore the first clause of the judgment that says WPS can go ahead on cross-claim, I would then say, okay, covers Aegis too. You know, it's they're either in or they're out, and if they're in with WPS, then they ought to get the benefit of one. If they're not in with WPS, then why interpret 172 to make them in? But I think you should go on and tell us what the second and third times were.
All right.
Because I think those are good to look at.
Okay.
Because this is all on the record, right? This is all on the record.
Sure.
We're not going outside the record to look at intent or anything else.
Absolutely.
You have to just get everything from the record.
All right. The next instance is that WPS files actually two documents entitled cross-claim. One is the one that Chief Justice Abramson referred to earlier.
I know, and I thought maybe it was just a mistake of having two documents repeated.
No, it was purposeful.
Tell what the purpose was.
Well, it's not my pleading, but I believe, and this is true in general here, when you have pleadings made and then reincorporated. I think it's clear that the purpose here was that if this case had proceeded to trial, the Brooks case, that is, and had Aegis then wanted to introduce evidence on its indemnification claim, I would posit that if Arby said, no, Your Honor, that's not permissible because this claim has never been made, that argument would have been summarily rejected, because Aegis would have pointed to paragraph 172. They would have pointed to the specific cross-claim of WPS, which makes the indemnification claim on behalf of both itself and its insureds. They would have pointed to the second answer that was filed by the Von Briesen firm on behalf of Aegis, which then reincorporates all of the affirmative defenses made earlier. So why do attorneys do that? They want to be sure that they are covered so that they can introduce evidence at trial on this indemnification claim. But having done that, having laid out this claim, and I think I would refer to the court to the Geis case, which says, having made such a claim, you cannot sit back and watch the contest, in the words of that decision. Having made this claim, Aegis either had to pursue it or, in the negotiations for the settlement, like WPS, negotiate a carve-out or recognize that that claim is going to be dismissed. They did neither. They sat back and watched the contest. And so when the difficult negotiations were going on, even though they had made this claim, they permitted it. They agreed that it was dismissed with prejudice. And that's why the Court of Appeals should be affirmed. Just going on again in answer to the Chief Justice's question, the third instance was this August 27th answer, which again reincorporated the affirmative defenses made earlier. Now, we are faced with an argument of form over substance. This case boils down to the argument that if these same words had been labeled a cross-claim, we wouldn't be here. And because they're labeled as an affirmative defense, that somehow changes the calculus. There are lots of cases in the federal system, in answer to another of Judge Justice Rogensack's questions, that say indeed substance controls, not form. And the Mountain versus Chautauqua Airlines case is an excellent example. There the court said, by using the word indemnification in an answer, that was good enough to set forth a claim. We're going to take substance over form. And that's really what we're talking about here. The Schwabe case is also critical because that case recognizes that a claim within an affirmative defense has claim preclusion potential. If you make a claim in an affirmative defense and there is a judgment dismissing the case, that affirmative defense claim is dismissed as well, and that is the rule of the Schwabe case. Even if we don't recharacterize this affirmative defense, the fact is that it sets forth a claim for relief. And again, it is dismissed when the case is subsequently dismissed with prejudice. The Geis case also stands for the proposition that a response of pleading is not essential to create the adversity which we look for in the question of whether or not claim preclusion should apply. In the Geis case, there was no response of pleading to the claim made in that case.
Isn't Geisy really issue preclusion? I know the court says claim preclusion, but what the case turned on is that there was no liability in the first suit, and that issue of liability had to be present in order to make the person a tortfeasor in the second suit, and therefore you couldn't make the second suit. I know the court says claim preclusion, but I beg to differ. I think it's a case of issue preclusion.
Well, in the case, there were two co-defendants, Mount Mary College and Burkhart.
Right.
Mount Mary pleaded a claim against Burkhart.
Right.
Burkhart went forward and moved for summary judgment.
Right.
And even though Mount Mary College had made the claim, they sat back and watched the proceedings go forward on the summary judgment.
Absolutely.
And that resulted in a judgment in favor of Burkhart.
Right, and that they were not tortious. Their actions were not tortious.
True.
Right. That was what was determined in the first suit.
In second suit, actually, it was all part of one
case.
Yeah,
I know it was.
But it is like two suits.
Right.
In the second part, Mount Mary College said, wait a minute, we've got to resolve our differences with
right,
Burkhart.
Right.
The court said, and this court concluded, you cannot sit back and watch the contest. You made this claim. You either got to pursue it or you lose it. And that's claim preclusion, and that's exactly what we have in this case.
See, but that's not all they said, with due respect, counsel. What they said was you had to show negligence to get contribution. If you couldn't show the other party was negligent, you have no right of contribution. And because the issue of negligence was determined adversely in the first lawsuit, you couldn't proceed on the second lawsuit. But it was because that issue was decided and you had to have it for the second lawsuit, correct?
I totally agree. But like Geis, there was no response pleading.
Yeah, you're right.
And the court nevertheless determined that there was adversity for claim preclusion purposes. And it looked at two things. One, because under the rules of pleading at that time, we didn't have a reply to a cross-claim, the court said, you look to the rules, and they say those allegations are deemed denied. That creates adversity. Same is true with an affirmative defense in this case. The rules say, Rule 8 in the federal system, 8B6, I believe, says where there's no pleading required, those allegations are deemed denied. That creates adversity. But you can also look to the cross-claim filed by WPS. That cross-claim asserted the same indemnification claim. That's, I believe, in appellate 132 of the record. It asserted it, actually, on behalf of WPS and its insurers. That cross-claim was denied by Arby. So there was a response of pleading that denied the very same claim based on the very same contract.
What was your reference to the appendix?
I better check it.
Think so. I think that's 319, isn't it? WPS. Are you talking about the WPS claim?
The
cross claim?
The WPS.
Arby's response, I think that's
right. I'm sorry.
The claim is, the WPS one is 319.
Mm-hmm.
That's the general cross claim, which mentions. He just as a defendant against whom they are making claims.
294 is the beginning of Arby's response.
The one I was specifically referring, and again, WPS filed two cross claims, one a general cross claim and one a specific.
I don't think this specific cross claim is in this appendix. Otherwise, I've missed it.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It's hard to read the pages.
The number is.
But I believe the starting page is 127.
Okay. I'll go back.
Not 127A, but 127.
Well, the reason is late. Okay, I'll find it.
And specifically on page appellate 129, is where the indemnification claim is made on behalf of WPS and its insurers.
And that's the specific claim. And so where is Arby's answer?
Look at 294, counsel. I think that's where it starts. But see if that's correct.
Appendix 294 in my book. I mean, I think that's what you're talking about, but I don't want to. Okay, maybe you have something
the
else.
Answer, and then
yes.
The
that is the answer to the
complaint, affirmative defenses, cross claims, and response to cross. You also have 322, which is
yes.
Arby's construction answer to the general cross-claim by WPS.
Yes. The answer to the specific cross-claim is appellant's appendix 326 and 327. I'm sorry.
326? Right. That's right. That's labeled specific. They've got an answer to a cross-claim, too. But I don't think it's this cross claim somewhere else. It's on page 316, which is the end of the document that Justice Rogensack made reference to.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cross claim answer.
Yeah, it is except Arby, though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great, thanks.
And it's insurer. Then the specific one is 326.
Okay.
Were you representing Aegis at this point?
Yeah.
I mean, you're representing Arby's.
Yes.
But you're asserting a defense on behalf of Aegis?
No.
I mean, you signed the pleading that is the answer that includes Aegis.
At times, it could be that Arby represented Aegis insofar as Aegis was insuring Arby. I'm not sure what pleading you're referring to, but that's
the ones you just cited in 327.
Yes.
Now, you're on that. Mr. Priebus is the first named lawyer. But then there are several named Michael Best lawyers. And it says attorneys for defendant Arby, Old Republic, et cetera.
Yeah,
but if you look, go ahead.
I'm sorry. That pleading, we do assert a representation of certain insurers, but I don't believe Aegis is among them.
You don't represent Aegis in this one? You had a problem because Aegis was on your side sometimes and not on your side other times. That's the whole problem in the case.
Well, Aegis does have several roles in the case, yes. And it is unusual to be sued by your own insurance company. I will concede that.
Not if you owe them money.
Perhaps. That's the issue.
That's the question here, right?
Indeed. It is indeed.
but I think what's unusual in the case is that the same insurance company will, and there's nothing the matter with it, insure or indemnify many people. And it's consistent because they're indemnifying or they're insuring a WPS, which has a contract of indemnification from Arby, and they're going to insure both, so they make sure WPS in effect gets paid.
Yes, they wear different hats at different times.
But this case would be decided exactly the same way if we were now in a different federal court?
No, it wouldn't. It would not. Now, thank you for bringing that up, because there was a question about whether this is governed by federal or state law. The Semtec case makes it clear that
Which case?
Semtec, S-E-M-T-E-K. makes it clear that when you're talking about a diversity case as this one, the court would look to state law to determine the law of claim preclusion. So this is governed by state law, the effect of the court's judgment.
Yes, but I asked the question of whether if this was in a federal court interpreting this federal judgment, would they interpret this affirmative defense as a cross-claim? Because how can you know what this judgment means unless you know what a federal court would do with it?
Well, I think
that's a slight difference in questions.
All right.
And a slight, maybe a difference answer and maybe not.
I think the Mountain case, Mountain versus Chautauqua Airlines, is pretty instructive in that regard. In that case, there was no cross-claim for indemnification. There wasn't even an affirmative defense. They simply raised the word indemnification in the wherefore clause, as I recall. And Judge Adelman had no problem saying, we're going to look at substance here, not form. You've pleaded indemnification. We'll proceed to address the merits of that claim.
The only place indemnification was mentioned was in the claim for relief, the wherefore clause.
That's my recollection.
Mm-hmm. It was the, and in this case, is there any claim for relief pleaded in the equivalent wherefore clause?
Not in the wherefore clause. The claim
only in the affirmative defense
in
section.
The defense itself, but it's clear if you look at the language of the defense itself, it is a prayer for relief. They're seeking indemnification. And as the Court of Appeals pointed out, this is not an affirmative defense. It doesn't go to defeat any claim by the Brooks plaintiffs. It is simply a claim against Arby.
Was this a summary judgment or a motion for dismissal? And were there affidavits filed? Any matters outside just the plain records?
It was filed as a motion to dismiss.
Mm-hmm. Was it treated that way?
And I believe it was treated that way. The Court of Appeals decision and obviously pleadings were part of the motion to dismiss. But I believe the law is clear that the court can take judicial notice of pleadings. It doesn't create affidavits or issues of fact. So that's the format in which it was brought. But, of course, it could have been turned into a motion for summary judgment with the same effect. With that, I will simply ask the court to affirm the Court of Appeals' reasoned decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Westgate.
I would just briefly respond to you.
No, don't say anything until you get to the microphone because we can't, you don't pick it up on the recording.
I would just like to briefly respond to a few issues. Under Rule 16, Federal Rule 13, across G and H, a cross-claim is a separate claim, and it allows for joinder of separate cross-claim parties, which requires the institution of a new suit. A cross-claim under the federal rules is a new suit. It is a new lawsuit. Then briefly, Guy's and Schwab are both claim preclusion cases. Justice Rogan said is exactly correct with regard to Guy's. There was this contribution claim that was deemed to have been controverted, and then the issue that resolved negligence happened in the summary judgment, so they were precluded from that fact being further litigated. Schwab was a case in which, I think it was a rental situation, but an affirmative defense was posed in the case. The defendant won and was able to bring a fraud action against the plaintiff. And that was allowed because it was because he won. So like in compulsory counterclaim, the defendant had won and was able to pursue the claim against the plaintiff. The Mountain case deserves further attention because, in fact, a contribution and indemnification claim was asserted as an affirmative defense, exactly as what is claimed to be occurring here. And a declaratory judgment action was brought. The court asked everybody, is it okay if we talk about these pleadings as a cross-claim? I'm going to consider whether I can take jurisdiction of this cross-claim, because in federal court, that cross-claim needs to have special ancillary jurisdiction. It doesn't just come along with the whole vote. You have to decide that it's part of the initial diversity action, that is, you have the right to have jurisdiction over it. The court made those decisions because it was so closely connected as a contribution and indemnity claim to the initial tort action, and everybody was there, and they agreed that it was going to be a cross-claim. So that's what happened with Montan. I think that I will now rest. Thank you.
Just one follow-up question, and I know we're not dealing generally with the federal rules here, and you had cited Federal Rule 5 to me when I asked you if this had been a cross-claim, would it need a summons? And you referred to that saying yes, and then opposing counsel said no, Federal Rule 8 permits it without a summons, and also there were many, many cross-claims in this case, and it was the practice in this case to permit them without a summons. Can you respond to his responses about whether we needed a summons here or not?
It's my understanding that unless that Rule 8, a cross-claim is a pleading that's governed by Rule 7 and Rule 8, I think that the cross-claim is instituted by the service of summons under 4 and 5, but that in multi-party litigation cases, it is possible for the court to make an order to say you don't have to do that. We have no evidence in this case that that occurred or did not occur. This was brought as a motion to dismiss. That was the other thing. Actually, Wisconsin law does not allow us to bring a motion to dismiss and bring in external evidence and external pleadings, and the Court of Appeals reminded all of us of that, despite the fact that both parties and the trial judge proceeded as if it was a motion to dismiss. Apparently, we could not under Wisconsin rules of civil procedure, that when the court looked at external, the pleadings from the federal court case, that converted it to a summary judgment. So did I?
That's why I got the idea about a summary judgment. I read it somewhere in this material. Okay, got it.
Thank you.
So it is a summary judgment?
I'm sorry?
Was it a summary judgment at the
trial
court?
Well, we didn't know until the Court of Appeals opinion came out that it was actually a summary judgment.
Well, then do we have all the material facts here?
I'm sorry. No.
Why don't you let go counsel?
Never mind. Respond or not. Mm-hmm.
You can respond. I didn't mean to shut you off at all. Sorry.
I had a hearing problem. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, this room is very difficult for all of us to hear, but I didn't mean to shut you off.
No. What was the question?
It was my question of whether this was a summary judgment and that there are material facts that have to be tried, or that this was a motion to dismiss and we should decide all of this on the paper. Consultation.
The question of whether there was the intent of the parties was never resolved. It was treated as a motion to dismiss in the trial court, and all that went in were these pleadings. Nothing was said about the intent of the parties.
It was all paper.
Yeah, it was all paper and just pleadings. Nothing about the settlement. No information regarding the settlement was put in or what the intent of the parties were to the settlement, mm-hmm. whether anybody ever talked about whether this was a cross-claim or an affirmative defense or none of that.
None of
that happened.
Okay. I understand. Thank you, Mary. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
I ask another question. I asked your opposing counsel if the result would be the same if there was a suit in another federal court. And I thought the answer was no. I think that was the answer, and I think you cited the Semtec case. You represent a New Jersey corporation? Aegis?
A A New Jersey corporation? No.
Oh, that's not. It, was there any possibility of another diversity suit?
With Aegis?
Yeah.
On this case?
Yeah.
You mean like if it would end up in New Jersey?
I think what Justice, well, I'm going to give it a try. I may not have your question correct. I think what Justice Prosser is asking is if you had been able to sue, or if the Wisconsin Public Service Co-op and Aegis sued Arby in federal court,
mm-hmm.
and you had the exact same suit in federal court.
I see.
Let's say they had jurisdiction. I don't want to get into that. Would the federal court say that the affirmative defense was functionally a cross-claim that was wiped out by number one and number two in the judgment? That's the question.
Exactly.
So would you get the same result in Fed or in state?
I don't believe there's any authority to believe that a federal court would find a functionally equivalent cross-claim.
And you say the answer is the same result should be federal and state, and that in feds the result would be you would win, and you discount the cases that Mr. Graupner relies on.
You mean Semtech?
Yeah, Semtech and Montana.
I don't discount Semtech as a situation where the court, when the court, the diversity court in Brooks was sitting and making the judgment, it was to apply the law of the state of its forum. At that time, the law of the state of its forum was exactly the same as the general federal law.
I understand. I misstated your position.
At that judgment point, the state and the federal were exactly the same.
That's right. So you would have applied, you would have had the federal, Judge Griesbach apply Wisconsin law, and it would have been the same in your opinion. So that's where the Wisconsin law is applied. You're not fighting that issue.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And Judge, Justice Prosser?
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Terwilliger, Ms. Westgate, and Mr. Graupner for excellent arguments on a very difficult issue involving federal-state relations in two cases and issues that are not easy relating to claim preclusion or cross-claims when they're not required. So I found your briefs very interesting on these difficult issues and your arguments, which leaves the court to ponder. That closes our hearing on 10 AP878 WPS Co-op versus RB Construction. The students should remain seated, and Justice Crooks will be out momentarily. After he stretches, right. Oh, they may stretch. Okay. Students should rise and stretch quietly. That ends it.